The 100 Years' War, the company's period, 1357 to 1359. The Gascon Companies, Part 3, still in Provence. Now, our old friend, the archpriest, was causing lots of problems. Struck by the boldness of the archpriest's enterprise and the ease of his conquests, other captains of the southwest began to cast envious eyes on the territories beyond the Rhone River. According to reports reaching the papal court, the Captal de Buch, Lord of Musedin, and the Count of Armagnac were all arming to join in the rape of Provence. This may or may not have been true for the first two, but it was certainly true for the last. Armagnac had large territorial claims of his own in Provence, which he had unsuccessfully pressed on the Queen of Naples for several years. And about May 1357, when the preparations of the archpriest became public knowledge, he began to raise his own army, the kernel of which consisted, like the archpriest's own, disbanded Gascon troops. It was probably the advance guard of this army which was reported to be gathering on the west bank of the Rhone during August of 1357. In the middle of the month, as the archpriest's men were filling the valley of the Durance, those of the Count of Armagnac crossed the Rhone south St. Giles. The representatives of Jeanne's government in Provence were her brother-in-law, Philip of Toronto, and the seneschal, Fulk d'Auguste, both of them quite unequal to the challenge. Philip had collected a small force of cavalry on the archpriest's approach, with which he had failed to hold the line of the Durance River. He then fled to Avignon, where he swiftly was joined by Fulk. The papal city was in a state of panic. The ancient walls had been partly demolished at the time of the Albigensian Wars in the early 13th century and simply never rebuilt. The Pope ordered hurried works to be carried out in the gaps and hired several hundred extra garrison troops. Urgent appeals for help were addressed to the Emperor, the imprisoned King of France, the Count of Savoy, and other potentates. Some of them promised to help, but none did so. At the beginning of September 1357, the frightened politicians in Avignon decided to play off one group of routiers against the other. They sent that practiced compromiser, the Cardinal of Boulogne, to treat with the Count of Armagnac. On September 13, 1357, Armagnac was bought out. He agreed to enter the service of the Queen of Naples for 2.5 months and with an army of 1,000 cavalry and 1,500 mounted infantry. For their part, the Queen's officers undertook to raise another 8,000 men to fight under his command. Together, they would confront the horde of the archpriest. For these services, Armagnac was to have all his territorial claims in Provence satisfied promptly and in full, and to receive in addition a large cash fee, 65,000 gold florins. It was probably worth paying this to get rid of him, but it made very little difference to the fight against the archpriest. At the beginning of October 1357, the Count of Armagnac's army set up its headquarters at Tarascon on the east bank of the Rhone River. In November, they marched east towards Aix and joined forces with the seneschal. Here they attacked two castles north of Aix, where the rebels had established themselves, but they made no impression on one, and having failed to capture the other, eventually bought out the garrison for 4,000 florins. The great army which the seneschal had promised to raise in Provence, of course, never materialized. In the new year, Armagnac fell out with his employers and returned abruptly to Languedoc, whence he carried on an acrimonious correspondence with the seneschal about the arrears of his pay. The seneschal, who was struggling to raise money in Avignon, suffered the indignity of being arrested as a common debtor. As soon as the Count of Armagnac had departed, the Provençal rebels launched a fresh offensive, the ultimate objective, which was to capture the city of Marseille. The troops were mostly mercenaries from southwestern France, commanded by Raymond de Beau. Gascons, but worse than barbarians or Saracens, as the terrified inhabitants of one village reported. Operations began in the middle of January 1358 in the coastal region east of the city. The archpriest's army advanced simultaneously from the north. They poured down the Durance from the Fourcouliers to Mansk in bands of a few hundred at a time and converged on an agreed meeting point. The meeting point was the pilgrimage town of Saint-Maxime-le-Saint-le-Baume. St. Maximin had had many warnings of their comings. The relics of St. Mary Magdalene had already been carried off to the hills, but the inhabitants were taken by surprise. The great company approached with banners bearing the arms of the Queen of Naples and the city of Marseille. They remained undetected until they were almost at the walls. Men working in the suburban vineyards fled for their lives. On February the 21st, 1358, the town was taken by assault and subjected to a brutal sack. The remnant of the Count of Armagnac's army, some companies of which had stayed behind after the Count's withdrawal, melted away. At the beginning of March 1358, the archpriest established his headquarters at Pélisson, east of Salon, and began to make final preparations for the assault on Marseille. By his own reckoning, he had about 2,700 men with him, not including the inevitable trail of camp followers and thieves. Well, Marseille saved Provence. Its citizens cut fresh ditches around their walls. They demolished the bridges leading to the gates. They expelled every inhabitant born on the domains of Raymond de Beaux. They were all ready for the assault, but it never came. The archpriest assembled a good deal of intelligence about the layout of the defenses and drew obvious conclusions. The city was too large and too populous to be taken by storm. It could not be blockaded without a fleet. The rebels and their auxiliaries were in a much greater danger of starvation than the inhabitants. Failure of the harvest, the looting of the granaries, and the scorched earth policies organized by the officers of the queen had brought the Place Pat north of Marseille to the edge of famine, leaving her enemies no means of feeding themselves. There was little booty left to be taken. Reports from the Ile-de-France, where the Anglo-Navarrese companies were closing in on Paris, suggested that the prospect of loot was better in the north. In the course of March 1358, the troops of Raymond de Beaux and the archpriest began to drift away. The archpriest himself turned north in April. He left some of his lieutenants behind to extract protection money from the communities of Provence, but as their numbers declined, so did their bargaining power. In September 1358, Arnaud returned to make a deal with the representatives of the Pope. He agreed to withdraw his companies from Provence and to restore all the castles which they had occupied in the papal territories of the Commandant Vesin and neighboring parts of the county of Faucouleurs. In return, he received the comparatively modest sum, 20,000 gold florins, which was to be levied on the communities of Provence. Pope Innocent himself advanced the first installment. In October, the archpriest led the last remnants of the great company back up the Rhone Valley. Deprived of the support of the Gascons, the rebellion in Provence swiftly fell apart. The rebels strangling Aix, Marseille, and Toulon were picked off one by one by troops sent out by the cities. Raymond de Beaux went on fighting until the end of 1359, but his cause was ruined and his career ended in disgrace and imprisonment. How much the soldiers of the great company had gotten out of the whole enterprise is hard to say. The sack of St. Maximin and the ransoming of the Durance Valley must have been very profitable, but the great company had failed to take a single large city or to establish themselves on the Rhone River. Most of them must have been disappointed by their receipts and glad enough to head north. And this is a perfect example of what goes on all during the Hundred Years' War. When you have those times where general peace breaks out, there's a lot of employment amongst the troops of the major powers, and they're just let loose. Then they become these free companies, these white companies, and this goes back and forth and back and forth. You can even find an example of this in Spain. 1492, you have the defeat of the Muslims in Spain. Spain is going to be unified, so all of the, quote, conquistadors are now not needed, and so they are unemployed, just at the time that the New World is discovered. So it's not a wonder that all of these people looking for loot and gold end up coming in on ships following the Columbus expedition, and you have the conquest of Mexico and Peru. Now the sources for this, History of the Hundred Years' War by Nylands, The History of the Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War Volume 2, Trial by Fire by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com. Ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.